Recording. It says we're recording.
And we believe it. Foolish me.
All right. Can you hear me? No. So, you almost though can. All right, we'll go up a little bit. How's that? Now can you? All right, news of the day. There's the big news. If you passed the eco exam, you could ignore all the good news. That is the good news if you passed it. Retake here after class. We'll take a potty break and then we'll do that. If you can't stay today or need an extra day to study, tomorrow at 4 in Living Learning A161. How many of you think you might do the 4 o'clock tomorrow? I guess the room will be big enough. Thank you. Otherwise, if you can't do either of them, email us to schedule and do that soon, because the Friday after spring break will be the last day to do it for the available points now. After that, the available points will drop by 10 again. And so, do it. Other questions? Yes. I'm sorry.
On the retake today.
Yes.
How many are we last minute? Yeah, the last
one. Oh. We don't know. Not very many. But we don't know because Julie hasn't seen the exam yet and we have to go over it together. She trusted me. So we will determine that later. But it won't be very many. You still have to pass it at a high level. Okay. just before class, I had a couple of questions. This is really frightening, and it should discourage some of you, but people are starting to work on assignment 5 and want to know what we're looking for. So I'll try to make something up. It's scary to me because I still have to read assignment 4 over break. But for those of you who want to do assignment 5 over break, or are working on it now and have it finished before break, or immediately when you get back, this assignment 5 is designed to let you try to put Bronfenbrenner's principles into some organized framework for yourself in language that you can claim as your own. So the assignment is, it's in the syllabus, but the goal in this assignment is to sort out from Bronfenbrenner's framework a clear statement of your understanding of what conditions of the ecosystem are most supportive of human development. Okay. So as he's talked about propositions and about the hypotheses, you get to sort out what would an ideal ecosystem look like if it were going to support human development. This will require that you study the hypotheses pertinent to each element of the system and try to abstract the important features and then synthesize them into a set of principles. General statements. Principle is a general statement that express how an ideal ecosystem would operate. So think about an ideal ecosystem. If you really wanted to set up your ecosystem or an ecosystem so that it supported development as fully as possible, what would the relations in it look like? What kinds of dyads would be there? What would the microsystem look like? Okay. What would be the characteristics of the mesosystem, the exosystem, and the macrosystem? Okay. So think about each element, macro, micro, exo, and roles, relationships, and activities and try to think about how an ideal ecosystem for supporting development would be structured. Okay? What would the dyads be like? What would the activities be like? And think about it for a developing person. What would the mesosystem be like? Okay? You don't have to create a world. So you don't have to say, in perfect land, the following people would exist and they would behave this way. Use Bronfenbrenner's concepts and write general principles. Does that seem vague enough? Okay, good. We succeeded. Yes? No, I don't want you to state the hypothesis at all. I want you to take the hypotheses and abstract from it, from them, the characteristics of an ideal mesosystem, for example. There is no canned answer. What happens is that you have to wrestle your way through the book again and the hypotheses and think, okay, what does this mean for an ideal ecosystem? And after you've done that and we've graded it and then you've perfected it, you can take that with you as a blueprint for the rest of your life. For any job you get, for your family, for raising kids, for being president, whatever it is you're going to do, you can have, okay, these are the characteristics of the ideal developmentally facilitating ecosystem, and I'll just follow these. Constitution for Human Development, according to Bronfenbrenner. Okay. Other questions or troubles? Okay. I'm going to throw out a general challenge for you. As you go through the ecological transition over this weekend into a new setting, some of you will be going into old familiar settings next week. Some of you will be going into completely new settings. Take your Bronfenbrennerian understanding with you and analyze those settings, the transitions, your roles, the activities, and see if what you're doing facilitates your development or whether it is going to set you back a few degrees. Okay? And then you can come back and tell us how your spring break developmental, your ecological transitions facilitated your development. Okay, today, let's see. Now, I wanted to say one more thing about, I guess I won't. I had one more thing that I wanted to say about Monday's, or at the end of Monday's lecture, and I didn't bring my notes for it, so I'm not going to reconstruct it because I'll get off. So, okay, when you come back, we'll do that. So for today, you had an assignment. What is love? What kind of romantic dyadic relationship would you like to have? And what are the most common problems you and people you know encounter in romantic relationships? So, what is love? Anybody wrestle with it? Yes? When you feel all warm and fuzzy inside. That's also synonymous with the flu, you know. Okay, where does warm come in developmental terms? And what is fuzzy? Positive affect. Okay, when warm and fuzzy is not the flu, warm and fuzzy it feels good, right? Warm and fuzzy is, you like that. So the affect, when you are in love, or when you think about love, or when you are in a loving relationship, the affect is positive. And you like to maintain that affect. Okay? What else goes into a definition of love, or a description of love? Yes? Love is a primary dyad. Okay. So when you love someone, you tend to think about that person a lot, even if you're not with the person. Okay. Okay, in love there's a balance of power. Huh. Okay. Do parents love infants? Yeah. Power balance? No. Okay, well, okay, hang on to that one for the next question. Okay, what are the characteristics of a romantic relationship that you might want to have? And the difference is, the distinction that I've just made, is that love might apply in relationships in which people are very different developmental statuses, parent and child, parent and infant. So the power might be very unbalanced, maybe very one-sided. But when you think about a romantic relationship, presumably you are going to be talking about a relationship between developmental equals, peers, in which ideally the power would be balanced. You would have equal power in it, and power wouldn't be an issue.
I would argue that the affect would also be negative as well, possibly, just because I think a good characteristic of romantic love is that you're constantly trying to overcome problems or, you know, work on the relationship, understanding the other person.
Okay, the observation is that love might also include negative affect because you are trying to
understand where they're coming from.
Okay, and that might lead to negative affect? And you're working to get out of the negativity, to overcome it, to work toward positive affect. Okay? Let me translate that, or extend it one more step, which is that in a loving relationship, whether it's parent-child, grandparent, grandchild, partner, when there is negative affect, there is also motivation to return to a state of positive affect, okay, and to try to encourage positive affect for both people. In other words, love might include motivation to make the affect positive, to work toward making the affect positive if it's negative. That's not the same as saying that the loving relationship involves having negative affect. It's also not the same as the false claim, I will assert that it's false, that there's always negative affect in loving relationships, that you should expect that. So if you don't like the other person, you can still have a relationship that's loving and everybody hates their partner once in a while. That's not true. That's a way of staying in a relationship that is unhealthy. If a relationship involves regular negative affect, if you're angry about or feel bad about the relationship regularly, that's not love. That's an indication that you probably ought to bail quickly. But that's Uncle Larry's interpretation. But Uncle Larry knows that it is not necessary for a loving relationship or partner relationship to have negative feeling, negative affect. Yes? Okay, you want a high level of reciprocity in love? What does that mean? Okay, so there is mutual and reciprocal initiation of activities and trading of roles, or at least attempts to do that, attempts to understand the other person's perspective. That's something that we haven't talked about as an example of reciprocity, but it's an important example of reciprocity when you try to take the other person's perspective, put yourself in that person's shoes, and understand how that person is seeing the world. If you love somebody, you'd like that to happen. If you're a parent loving a child, it might be helpful to try to see the world from the child's perspective, try to understand what the child is trying to do. If you're a child, learning to take your parents' perspective might be a sign that you are, in fact, being loving. Remember that when you have teenagers. Too late for most of you. But when you're in a loving relationship with your parents and they're bugging you, it might be helpful to try to figure out why they're bugging you. Not what's wrong with them, but what's their view of the world. So that you're reciprocating the perspective. You're taking theirs and encouraging them to understand yours. So you're articulating your own so that they can understand your perspective. The important aspect of reciprocity that we didn't talk about. Okay. Other aspects of love? Yes. Commitment, devotion. What do those mean developmentally? Yes, you do. Commitment means that you hang in, right? Devotion means you hang in. Or does it mean you burn candles? No, it means you hang in. It means you stick with the person. Think about molar activity. Commitment is momentum to continue the relationship, to engage in joint activities with the person, to continue it. So what commitment and devotion represent, translated into Brahmacharya terms, is that the relationship becomes or is a molar activity. Love is a molar activity that has meaning, right? That has momentum. You want to continue it. You get annoyed if somebody ends it. Right? It's called breaking up. Why do people get annoyed when you break up with them? Because it was a molar activity for them. And they're not continuing. So they're not continuing, not sharing the momentum with you. Love is a molar activity. And commitment and devotion mean that you want to stick with it. You want to continue it. You want to do the things that people do when they love somebody, including initiating joint activities, increasing the affect, moving it toward the positive, not increasing it, moving it, making it more positive. Understanding the other person, increasing the reciprocity, sharing your perspective with the other person so that he or she can understand how you see the world, doing that reciprocally, encouraging the other person's development, helping to make the activities more complex, creating a harmonious microsystem when you're in the same space, whether it's temporary or whether you're cohabiting. Okay. Those are proximal processes. So when you think about love, you think about what are the proximal processes? What is going on in the dyad that we say is a loving dyad? The dyad that we have with the person that we say we love, whether it's our parent, our sibling, our grandparent, our child, our grandchild, our romantic partner. How do you express love? You express it by seeing it and feeling it as a molar activity, joint activities, moving always, if you can, to positive affect for both of you, okay, which means trying to please the other person, help the other person become happier and warmer and fuzzier inside, moving toward sharing power, a high degree of reciprocity. Does that all make sense within Bronfenbrenner's perspective? When we get to the third question of what are the problems that people typically have, we'll come back to what do people not do. Is love similar to not just a primary dyad, but is it similar to a developmental dyad? For the parent-child relationship, creating a developmental dyad, engaging in increasingly complex activities, sharing those activities with the child, having positive affect with the child, seeking the company of the child, okay, sharing reciprocally your interests with the child, all of those characteristics of a developmental dyad would represent love for the child. And we say the child loves us when we're sitting on the couch with the flu and the kid comes in, right? This is the 14-month-old comes in. What does the 14-month-old who loves you do when you have the flu? Hands you her teddy bear. Says, here, mommy, feel better. Now, the 14-month-old doesn't say, mommy, feel better. But that's what the gesture says. Okay. We've already slopped over into what kind of romantic dyadic relationship you would like to have. I think. Positive affect? Yeah? A high degree of reciprocity, balance of power? You want it to be a primary dyad? You want the joint activities to be increasingly complex? And you probably want it to be a transcontextual dyad. Right? You'd like to share settings with the other person. Okay. Other things that you had thought about as you would think about the romantic relationship you would like to have, what would you like the other person to do? Yes. What? You want to be the... You want it to be a dyad. Ooh. You want to be the only one. Gosh. Maybe Bronfenbrenner's onto something when he said there's something really special about dyads. You don't want a triad? You don't want to share? No? The very important point, we are largely monogamous, or at least we want the other person to be monogamous. This is a very interesting point at which some couples have difficulty with the reciprocity. You want the other person to be monogamous, but certainly not during spring break. You should be monogamous, but so you would like that to be reciprocal, and you'll both be monogamous and be the only person, and most of us want that in a relationship. Let me throw out a question that I was going to use later in the semester, but let me just throw it out as a thought experiment for you to play with, which is, if you were going to have two romantic partners. If you were, for example, going to be a bigamist and have two spouses, how would you describe the ecosystem that you would have to set up for that to work? This is called the, and I hope nobody will take offense, but if you do, let me know, and we'll talk about it. Bigamy is illegal in Utah now. There are still communities where people do bigamy, but it's illegal. They just threw a judge out of office because he had two wives, three wives, six wives. I don't know how many he had, but anyway, they said you can't be a judge and breaking the law at the same time. Think about what kind of ecosystem you would have to set up to make bigamy work. Just thought experiment. I don't want to pursue it right now. I want to go back to... Sternberg. Yeah. What? You want one course to relate to the other? Yeah. Yeah, it would. Okay. Except that Sternberg, and the way we could relate it, is that Sternberg, in his description of love, is talking about different kinds of love. Different kinds of love. And what would be interesting as an experiment, an application of Bronfenbrenner, would be to think about the characteristics of the dyad, the activities, and the characteristics of the dyad that would characterize each of those types of love that he describes. They're different kinds of dyads. Nice point, thank you. You want a consummate romantic relationship, right? You want the passion, you want the intimacy, you want the companionship. Put all of them together and you've got the whole ball of wax. Or can of worms, as however you consider love. But how would you describe that in Bronfenbrennerian terms? What would be the characteristics of the dyad that you would like to have? Other characteristics of the romantic relationships that you want? You got to put something in the personal ad. What's it going to be? What are you seeking? What are you offering in the romantic relationship you'd like to have? Go out of your way for each other? What does that mean? Go out of your way. Mm-hmm. Self-sacrificing? Placing the other person at least at the same level of importance as self? And one of the challenges is how to do that, how to consider the other person and his or her desires to be as important as your own without losing your own. And Brunnenbrenner doesn't really tackle that, except it's an aspect of reciprocity. It's also an aspect of a balance of power. It also means that you place the relationship as a very important molar activity in your life. So when you go out of your way to be with the other person, to engage in a joint activity with the other person, to explore the world with the other person, you're choosing the relationship and its activities over whatever other molar activity might be important to you. Okay. So you'd like that to happen. You would like your romantic relationship to be as important as just about anything else for your romantic partner, and you would put it at the same level. Okay. So that if it infringes on your bowling, you'd like to be more important than bowling. Right? Where do I stand in the hierarchy of molar activities that my partner engages in? Do you always have to be first? Some people believe they need to be first. That can get you in deep difficulty in some relationships. For example, if you have children and are dating again in a romantic mood, or if you're dating somebody who has children, if any of you are doing that, Uncle Larry's observation is that the other person's parenthood is more important than the relationship with you. New partners are secondary to children. This is a problem for people who don't have children, who date people who do have, because they often want to be first, and they get annoyed if a parent actually engages in parenting behavior and says, "I can't do that with you because that's my weekend with my kids and I'm going to do that and we'll work out a way for you to join us." And then, "I want to be alone with you." You start to lose immediately. So if you're ever in the position of having children and being available for romantic relationships, Uncle Larry's advice is that you make it clear to all potential romantic partners that you are a package, you have children, and that parenting is more important to you than having a romantic relationship. Because you're not responsible for that romantic partner. You're responsible for your children. And if you put the romantic partner first and ignore your children will feel about you as some of you feel about your parents, I suspect. Because your parents didn't put you first, they ignored you, they didn't fulfill their commitments to you because their girlfriend, boyfriend didn't want them to, and they chose the girlfriend or boyfriend or the second spouse over you. And you don't want to do that to kids because they resent it and they don't deserve it and you shouldn't do it. So if you're the partner or trying to be the partner of somebody who has parenting responsibilities, your best bet is to support the person's parenting at your own expense in the short run, to your own benefit in the long run. It keeps you from being the evil stepmother. It keeps you from being told to take a walk, take a hike and don't come back, by the parent who is taking the parenting as the most important responsibility. Another example. Some of you are trying to have romantic relationships, or will in the future, or have in the past, with people for whom drinking is a more important molar activity than being in a relationship. Right? Instead of talking to you, having fun with you, engaging in joint activities, they would rather drink or do drugs. They're putting that molar activity ahead of the relationship, and it makes you feel you're not terribly important. And you're not. So if the person is doing that, that's a good time to take a walk. Because you won't rescue them. You won't ever be as important as alcohol to an alcoholic. Nothing. To somebody who's addicted to chemicals, nothing, including the relationship, will be as important. There's no point competing with something that somebody is addicted to. If you're already in the marriage and committed and devoted to the person and you've known them in their sober moments, you might want to hang in for a while and help them get over it. But they won't get over it because of you. You won't be that important to them. You'll be important again when they get over it, but that's a separate issue. Supportive partners, if a person has in fact gotten dry, and is no longer an alcoholic, no longer an active alcoholic, then the supportive relationships that have become important may help prevent relapses. On the other hand, in some cases they fuel the relapses because alcohol is one of the ways we deal with negative affect. Self-medication. So if you're feeling bad, you feel better and get all warm and fuzzy inside by drinking a little. And if you're a recovering alcoholic, that doesn't work. Another thought went in and out of my head. It's gone. So you want the romantic relationship, the partner relationship, to be a very high priority molar activity, but not necessarily the most important molar activity. And that means you may have to accept being second fiddle to other really important people, such as children. Or you may be trying to have a romantic relationship with somebody who is driven to succeed or accomplish or to do something specific that you can respect, and you recognize that there are going to be times when that's going to be more important. Don't take the paintbrush out of a compulsive artist's hand and say, be in the relationship with me. Offer to be the model instead. Or talk about the painting, hang out in the studio, but taking someone away from something that they're driven to do is going to lead to negative affect. You don't want that. Other thoughts about what you want? Physical attraction. What? What's sex got to do with it? Okay. Good. Okay, so you want some chemistry, you want the basic biology to be working, you want not just the physical attraction, but the attraction of personality, lifestyle, activities. So you want some common interests, joint activities, and you want sex to be one of those joint activities that becomes more complex and that you both enjoy. Okay. Yeah, it's really important. So you want to know something about the person. And hang on to that notion that having a little bit of information about somebody that's valid, hang on to that notion that that might apply in relationships, because it's one of Bronfenbrenner's hypotheses about settings. If you have valid information about the setting that you're about to enter in advance, that helps your entrance into that setting. There's a potential, and we'll get to it in a minute, but there's a potential that, I'll just throw this out, there's a potential that the hypotheses about the mesosystem might have parallels in the world of dyadic relationships. If you have information about a person before you are involved with that person, it may help the initial entry into that person, into a relationship with that person. You might want to go through all of the mesosystem hypotheses and see how far you can push that notion. Bronfenbrenner doesn't, but if it's a reasonable system, there ought to be parallels across levels like that, if it's a useful system. You want your mother to approve. Yeah. Right. The observation is from Bronfenbrenner that dyads that you're involved in with other people can be supportive or not of a particular dyad. So if you're thinking about your romantic relationship dyad, it's helpful if the other dyads you're in support that dyad. So if your parents approve, that helps. If his parents approve or her parents approve, that helps. If your friends approve, if you're hanging around people who don't like your partner, it's likely to interfere with both your dyad with them because they're disagreeing with you, disapproving of you, and it's likely to interfere with your dyad with the partner. Unless you're a headstrong, wet behind the ears teenager whose parents don't like your boyfriend or girlfriend, and if your parents are smart, they let you discover what's wrong with your boyfriend or girlfriend on your own, rather than tell you, because we all know as parents that if we express displeasure about our children's partners, that will drive them to get pregnant and get married. To spite their parents. Very strange thing that happens, and it indicates unfinished development when you do things to spite other people or to prove your independence from them. But once you're in adulthood, it helps if your friends and your parents like the people that you bring into the family. I've always been very pleased that I can say that both my kids improved the quality of the family by their partners, by bringing them in. My son-in-law and my daughter-in-law are both beautiful people. They're wonderful. Great to hang out with. In fact, I like them better than my kids sometimes. Not very often, but sometimes. And I like what they do for my children in helping them become better people. Anyway.
You were saying that it helps to know something of the person before. Does that mean that you Sunday school, that you have a rule of dating friends.
Mm-hmm. What do you think? Does it help to be friends before you become romantic partners? Yeah. Why? Because friendship involves intimacy. You have the friendship, you have the positive affect, you have joint activities, you have knowledge of each other's mesosystems and the microsystems that you each participate in as friends before you develop the kinds of emotions that tend to be more disorienting. And I'm wrestling in my head with the separation between romantic partners and sexual partners. So I'm going to extend Anu's comment that it might be helpful to think about a progression for the dyad from friendship to romance to sexuality. Think about the activities involved in each of those three types of dyads, if you want. Friends, romantic partners, people who are dating, getting to know each other with the physical attraction and interest in creating a partnership that's different from a friendship, and then consummating that as it becomes sexual. And it's very easy to see that the sexuality isn't going to work without the friendship. Which is why your one-night stands don't make it. Because the only joint activity you have is drinking and sex, and those two won't get you very far in the process of dating. It's hard to get back to friendship. It's a very interesting point. But if you enter a romantic relationship with the commitment to be friends if it doesn't work out. No, it doesn't always work, but it's an interesting way to think about relationships, because if you have that commitment to each other, and it is something that you can commit to with each other, and it's more likely that you will do that if you're friends first, because you have a degree of intimacy about relationships and your friendship, you can talk about its value to you and your desire to have that be primary and continue as you move into a romantic relationship, which you always ought to do with some degree of anxiety and fear, trepidation. You know, if you're going to change the nature of the relationship. Part of that process can be a negotiation around committing to being friends if it doesn't work out, or being friends after you divorce. You can make that commitment to each other. Why would you want to do that? Because if you have that commitment, you have a sense of the ecosystem that you would like to have post-romance, or post-marriage, or post-sexuality, whatever it is, you have a view of the world that as you want it to be, and that means that you treat each other differently during the relationship, and it means that you break up differently. And that's a very important point. How do you break up with somebody? Love is easy. Love is really easy. Romantic relationships are a piece of cake. The problems come when we try to break up. None of us knows how to do that. We make a mess of that. We screw that up so badly that we end up at the counseling center. We end up hurting each other. We end up saying things that are really nasty. We end up being the worst person we can imagine ourselves being when we break up. Should write a book about how to actually there are books about how to break up. To break up well is more likely if you have committed to being friends after you break up. And you did that when you were beginning the relationship. Then you can say to the person, oh, wait a minute, you know, we need to continue our friendship here, which is we need to be honest about what's going on in the relationship. We need to communicate intimately about that. We need to agree to disagree, as friends will. And we need to treat each other in ways that will allow us to continue to be friends rather than having really negative, nasty feelings about each other because we treat each other like dirt while we're breaking up. You can actually do that. You can actually break up in a way that allows you to be friends after. You can even divorce in a way that allows you to be friends after. But it means you don't cheat, you don't lie, you don't represent yourself as something that you're not. It means you don't behave badly toward the other person, you don't badmouth the other person, you try to be supportive of the other person while you're ending the, or changing the relationship. You can do that. It's an ideal. And it doesn't always work because the other person may not be cooperative. But at least if you take the high road and behave in a way that would allow you to continue the friendship, then it's up to the other person to choose to do that or not. And if the other person doesn't choose to and doesn't want to, then you don't want to be friends anyway. But you want to put yourself in a position where it's possible. Some of you probably have been or will be guests or participants in weddings where the best man is a former partner of the bride. That one I love. That one I love. When the best friend or the bridesmaid, one of the really funny ones that I went to is the bridesmaid was a guy. Because the bride chose her very best friend in the entire world to be her bridesmaid. You all want to do that, right? You want your bridesmaid to be your very, very best friend in the whole world. And this one happened to be a guy, and it happened to be a guy she'd had a sexual relationship with senior year in high school. And they ended it as friends, and they continued the friendship. And she ended up marrying one of his best friends. And they were fine with him being the best man. I mean, the bridesmaid. He was the second best man. People can do that. But you have to behave well in the relationship, which means you behave with positive affect. You don't throw any negativity into it while you're breaking up that isn't already there. You don't try to grab all the power. You maintain reciprocity with the other person. You treat the other person as an equal, even though you're breaking up. You encourage the other person to do that. You can go through that ecological transition, change your roles, change the nature of the dyad, and come out feeling and being competent. Somebody, and I've forgotten who, remind me to find out who the author was, who said that one way to go through life as well as a human being can is to try to create as few enemies as necessary. And it's an interesting way to think about your relationships. Create as few enemies as necessary. And the goal would be none. You may have enemies, but if you try not to create them, life will be easier and more fun. It's much better to have friends than enemies. Okay, here's what I said a minute ago. Try translating the mesosystem hypotheses into dyad hypotheses. You can think about that one. And then let's go to the third question. What are the most common problems you and your friends and roommates and siblings, parents have in their romantic relationships? Write down two, just in your notebook so we can come back to these. What are the most common problems people have? And then we'll play Bronfenbrenner. Joanna, you had your hand up first.
I was going to say that one person wants something that the other person, that they kind of assume things about the other person, that they want the thing and they automatically assume the other person wants that too.
Ah. Assuming that the other person thinks and feels as you do. Okay. Making the assumption that if you want something, the other person does too. And why is that a problem? Right, because when you're wrong, you end up with egg on your face, and the other person is annoyed. And if you do it routinely, the other person feels that you don't understand. And you're not trying to understand. You're not trying to take his or her perspective. You're making assumptions. That means you're trying to run the show. It means you're egocentric, which is fine for four-year-olds. But reciprocity requires taking the other person's perspective. It means getting over your egocentrism and recognizing the validity of the other person's point of view, the validity of the notion that the other person has a point of view and might want something different than you want, and actually expending the energy to try to find out what it might be. Yeah, that's a bad one. Low developmental status, sitting around doing nothing, right?
Yeah.
They hang out. Hanging out is not a molar activity, right? Or it's a very low level molar activity. And there are different ways to hang out. Some people hang out and invent new worlds and play games and have a great time and create a good deal of intimacy, and it's a shared joint activity, but that's really, they're not hanging out. They're engaging in joint activities that are becoming much more complex. And one of the things that kills a relationship is the feeling that there isn't any molar activity that's becoming more complex. He never wants to do anything. You know, I make suggestions, I ask, he, she doesn't have any ideas, doesn't like to do anything, doesn't want to go out, doesn't like that, and eventually you bail out. The problem boils down to trying to have a relationship with somebody whose developmental status is stunted. Do you like people who have ideas, who have interesting suggestions to make, who find something that they like to do, or something that's fun in almost anything they do, who likes new experiences? Of course you do. Those are highly developed people. The bump on the log, what happens in the relationship often is that a person fakes being developmentally mature for just long enough to get you committed to the relationship, and then what you realize is that, aha, the molar activity was snaring me. That's why the person was so active and energetic, because she was looking for a partner. Now that she's got me, she doesn't want to do any of those things anymore. Okay. So it was a temporary strategy to be interesting. But once you've got a partner, then you don't have to be interesting anymore. When your partner stops being interesting, it's time to bail.
Just
incompatibility of likes and dislikes. How do people get incompatible? What does that mean in developmental terms, you think? And they're two different. Did you say schedules? No. Okay. I'm going there, but later. Yeah. The schedules. Two different backgrounds, okay. Which boils down in Bronfenbrennerian terms. Think about the very definition of human development. A valid and differentiated view of the world you live in. If your views of the world are different, that may be a compatibility problem. For me to try to be in a romantic relationship with somebody who was a social conservative, who thought the poor deserved their status, who thought that the society owes the poor nothing, somebody who voted very conservatively, somebody who was not in favor of promoting the development of women or children, who voted against education budget, that person has a very different view of the world, and that would be a fatal incompatibility for us. We wouldn't get very far. Because we would fight all the time. And that having a very different view of the world leads sometimes to open conflict, sometimes to disrespect, and sometimes to just failure to be able to communicate. There are other kinds of incompatibility, liking different things and not enjoying the molar activities of the other person. Not appreciating them. That if you can't find joint activities that are important enough to both of you that you really enjoy, that they can become a central feature of the relationship, it's hard to figure out what to do, so you end up sitting around both being frustrated because you'd really rather be bowling, but the other person doesn't like bowling and gets annoyed if you go bowling, so you don't go. And the other person is sitting there wishing that you could go dry flowers or something. I don't know where that one came from. No, but it isn't interested in flowers or whatever you can do with dried flowers. What can you do with dried flowers? I don't know what you can do. You can make collages. Painting impressionist pictures with dried flower petals. If the other person doesn't like that and gets annoyed when there you are. Nothing to do. Together. So that's an incompatibility.
One of my problems with siblings in families, when my boyfriend and his sister and I clash.
The non-supportive dyadic, other dyadic relationships. The sister who doesn't like you because you take her brother away from her. You, her, them, it. And you're not good enough for him. Right? And you're going to compete with the rest of the family.
Yeah.
Jealousy. Why do people get jealous? What is jealousy developmentally?
Not trusting.
And why would you not trust somebody? What is trust? And what is mistrust? Developmentally. An interesting question. There you are in your microsystem with your dyadic relationship with the other person. We'll call them one and two. and there you are, and person two, your partner, is describing how she feels, what she thinks, how she behaves, declaring her undying interest in you and the intention to be monogamous, going back to our earlier discussion. And do you mistrust somebody while you're in the same space with them? You can. You can. And that can develop as you engage in activities and discover that the person changes characteristics depending on the activity that you're in, or does things that you're not sure you like. So you can mistrust the other person, but that's not jealousy. Jealousy is when you go into a different setting in the mesosystem, the one you share or the other person's mesosystem, and you see behavior. If you're there, you see behavior of the partner with other people that seems incompatible with the representation that he or she is making in the first setting with you. And it's the kind of behavior that might be called flirting or open seduction, or but it's not compatible with the role of being your partner. And if you're not in that setting and you find out about the fact that your partner was engaged in behavior that other people think was a little questionable for your partner, then you get jealous. What were you doing? When you start to question, the partner becomes defensive. Instead of being completely honest and reciprocal, And once you start getting defensive, then you start not trusting. The other person starts to shade the truth a little bit. So jealousy is the fear that the other person is not going to be consistent in his or her behavior with the role of partner to you. Or it may be the awareness that in fact the partner does have a relationship with somebody else or several somebody else's, that in which the partner does things you would like the partner to do with you, but she doesn't. I was talking to a couple of about 3 or 4 years ago, in which the husband was expressing his concern that with him, they'd been married 15 or so years, with him his wife was pretty much all business, and they didn't converse a lot about important things, and he was beginning to feel that she was kind of tired of the relationship, and he was doing some good things about trying to improve that. But what really annoyed him was that she would get on the phone with anybody else and become animated and funny and interesting, and they would go to parties or they would see somebody in the store, and her entire affect was much more positive and her personality much more engaging and animated than he was getting at home. And he was jealous, appropriately so. I put him in my notes. I didn't help them any, but I don't know what to do. Anybody would suggest that she treat him like a stranger and then he'd be fine. But I don't think she really liked him anymore, basically, but I don't know. But the behavior that makes you jealous is behavior that you might like to have in the dyad, but it's happening with somebody else. So it's an inconsistency of the person's behavior across settings or across relationships.
What about in a situation where the
Okay. Some of you have had the experience that goes along with this example of a person has constructed a set of expectations in relationships, in previous relationships. For whatever reason, perhaps as a child, having parents who weren't trustworthy, having siblings who were manipulative, having partners who were abusive, that can make you, you construct from that an expectation that people will not treat you well. And you take that into your new relationship, and you behave in that relationship in ways that suggest that you're expecting the other person to be worthy of your jealousy, when in fact the person isn't. So what's happened in that situation is that the person has constructed a view of the world and of relationships that they're applying, but it doesn't apply to you. And that creates a good deal of conflict. One of the clearest examples of that is what happens to women who've been in abusive relationships, particularly as children, when they've had abusive parents. One of the characteristics that they construct for themselves is being hypervigilant. One of the ways you keep yourself from getting hurt when you're in an abusive relationship is to anticipate situations where you might get abused, and you head them off. And so you do things in the relationship, you withdraw, or you do some diversionary tactic that keeps the other person from being directly angry or hostile to you. That, if you experience that as a child and through adolescence, you're developing a way of relating to other people that is looking for trouble so that you can head it off. And you get into a relationship with somebody who doesn't create trouble and is not hostile, you misinterpret what the person does. And you overreact, or you react in ways that are going to push the other person away. You're acting as if the person was going to hurt you, when in fact the person was completely innocent. And so you behave in a way that is consistent with your previous relationships, and you leave the poor partner befuddled. What is he doing? Why did he do that? Not understanding the behavior. If you get into that kind of relationship as the innocent person, it's helpful to know something about the previous history of your partner, to understand what kinds of strategies the person developed to deal with previous relationships and perhaps parent-child relationships, so you can understand what's happening to you. And then you can help the person perhaps understand that you don't have hostile intent. A typical thing that happens in that kind of situation is you ask a question just looking for information, and the partner who's hypervigilant gets defensive about that because that person assumes the question comes from that it's criticism. If you ask a question, that implies criticism rather than, I want to understand. I want to understand your viewpoint. It's not a criticism, it's just curiosity. But if you take it as potential criticism, then you respond in a defensive or hostile way. Don't question me. I'll give you those 2 minutes back sometime. Just remind me when you need them. Have a wonderful break. Stay safe. Don't do anything that will hurt your development. Thank you.